I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. It was a marathon session yesterday when Hillary Clinton testified before the House Select Committee on Benghazi. It was a highly partisan event with Republicans and Democrats squabbling with each other as Clinton answered questions about the attack on the U.S. consul in Libya on September 11, 2012, leaving four Americans dead, including the U.S. ambassador, Christopher Stevens. There have been other investigations by the House and Senate and by the Accountability Review Board about security lapses in Libya. This House committee has come under fire by Democrats for politicizing the investigation into Clinton, while Republicans claim they have been stymied in their efforts to find out what happened on that tragic day. Well, here to talk about yesterday's testimony is Rachel Bade. She's congressional reporter for Politico. And Rachel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Also with us is Anita Kumar, and she covers the White House for McClatchy Newspapers. And Anita, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Can I begin with you, Rachel? A lot of us watched this on television. You and Anita were in the room yesterday. What was it like? What was the atmosphere like inside that room?
Well, it was, I would say it went from extreme to extreme. Sometimes the crowd, you could actually look behind. I looked behind myself, and during some of the very technical back and forths, I saw people dozing off in with their eyes closed.
Really?
But at other times, we saw a lot of heated partisan bickering, some political theater as well. There were a couple moments there where Republicans would bring out props to sort of make a point. For instance, Peter Roskam, a Republican from Illinois, at one point took a piece of paper, held it up, and ripped it and said, "Madam Secretary, this is what you did to the security requests for additional protection in Libya. Rip." And that was everybody sort of quieted and waited for her response there. At another point, Susan Brooks, another Republican, brought out on the table and threw down a stack of emails from Hillary Clinton in 2011 that had to deal with Libya, and then put another stack right next to it, a very small stack in comparison, and said, why did Libya, as you know, the situation unraveled, the security got worse and worse there, why were you getting fewer and fewer emails about Libya? We saw Republicans basically try to project some sort of narrative that she wanted to help Libya during the civil war to oust Gaddafi for her own political purposes, and then the next year sort of went off the grid after that, after he had been ousted, allowing, you know, her diplomats to be overrun, the compound to be overrun. That was the narrative they were definitely trying to get to.
And I do want to pick up on some of that. Anita, let me get you into the conversation.
Sure.
You were there. What did you observe?
Well, I think Rachel is, you know, correct about what was going on. One thing I found interesting is that a lot of members of Congress that were not on the panel, not related, even at least one senator came in to sort of watch what was going on. I mean, it was really kind of a spectacle. You know, you had 11 hours. I guess by the end of the day, there weren't as many people. But it was very interesting that there were a lot of people at the Capitol that sort of came to watch, just spectators, interested people that maybe weren't affiliated or, you know, had anything to do with the committee. There was a lot of attention.
Yes, and I noticed this was shortly after everything was over. The chairman of the committee, Trey Gowdy, was interviewed, and basically said that he'd have to look at the transcripts, but on the face of it, after this 11 hours, he didn't feel like he had learned anything new. And I wonder to you, Anita, do you think anything new was learned yesterday?
I mean, we reported, and I think other people reported, that there was nothing significant. Now, there were different things that we heard that we had not heard before because the committee has had access to other documents, other emails. They've received other emails, and they've interviewed other witnesses than some of the other committees. I mean, that's definitely true. The thing about yesterday, though, was there was no one overall theme from the Republican side. They were asking a lot of questions about a lot of different things. They did not have, I guess a lot of people use the term, one, you know, particular smoking gun. There was not one thing that they wanted to really grill her on. So they were kind of all over the map. I do think that there were things learned. I just don't know that there are any of them significant enough now to make a difference.
Rachel, I do want to play Hillary Clinton actually in response to something that Democratic Representative Adam Schiff was saying. And it was so clear that the Republicans and Democrats were essentially at each other's throats at the hearing yesterday. But the question that Adam Schiff seemed to be raising and wanting her to answer was whether she actually cared about the fact that four people died, including Christopher Stevens. And let me play this, and then I'll give you a chance to respond.
You know, I would imagine I've thought more about what happened than all of you put together. I've lost more sleep than all of you put together. I have been racking my brain about what more could have been done or should have been done. And so when I took responsibility, I took it as a challenge and an obligation to make sure before I left the State Department that what we could learn, as I'm sure my predecessors did after Beirut and after Nairobi and Dar es Salaam and after all of the other attacks on our facilities, I'm sure all of them, Republican and Democrat alike, especially where there was loss of American life, said, okay, what must we do better? How do we protect the men and women that we send without weapons, without support from the military, into some of the most dangerous places in the world?
Rachel, what she seemed to be saying there is that there was a time in Congress when Republicans and Democrats could come together to deal with tragedies, whether it happened in Lebanon or in Kenya.
Yeah, she definitely earlier in the day was pretty soft, but definitely gave a lecture to Republicans, a soft lecture to Republicans. But throughout the day, we saw her increasingly pushing back more and more, saying eventually, you know, this is not relevant. Your question is not relevant to what happened. I think that that clip that you just played was a moment a lot of people wrote about. You know, she was calm, she was collected, she was reflecting emotionally, and it really played well in her favor. Back in 2013, when she came to testify before one of the congressional Benghazi investigative committees, she had sort of this outburst where she said, "What difference does it make?" And that ended up being the soundbite for the whole committee or all the news clips that picked up on that. There was no soundbite like that. She kept her calm for the fact that she was being grilled for 10 hours, more than 10 hours. She definitely did very well, given the accusations that were thrown at her. I would say that, you know, sometimes later in the day, it was really interesting because some of her facial expressions, you could tell she was getting more and more increasingly annoyed with some of the questions. At one point, Roskam was trying to accuse her of trying to push the, quote, Clinton doctrine, is what he called it, in Libya, trying to claim it as success. And she said, you know, what difference does this make?
She did not say that.
I'm sorry. That was from the last 2013. Exactly. She said, why is this relevant? And she said that a couple of times. And I think that a lot of people in the room, particularly Democrats, were very much feeling the same way. Where are you getting with these questions? Where are you going?
Well, what I found interesting, Anita, and she has taken responsibility for what happened on that day in Benghazi, Libya. But at the same time, she made it clear, and I think there's something like 70,000 people that work for the Department of State, is that there are people underneath her who make very specific decisions about security and about walls and about how many, you know, how much security you have at one facility for another. Can you flesh that out at all for us?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest, you know, I said that they were kind of all over the board, the Republicans. They did have a few sort of main talking points, and security was definitely up there. I mean, but this is not new. I mean, this has been going on for a few years. We know from previous investigations that the folks in Libya had asked for more security. We know that. Now, we don't know that that was necessarily for the facility in Benghazi, but they did ask for it in Tripoli. And there was a lot of questions about whether she knew about those requests. And her point is, you don't come to the Secretary of State for those requests. They did make those requests. The ambassador made those requests, but they didn't necessarily go to her. They did not come up to her level, and she didn't know. And this, you know, evolved into a different, like a questioning where basically they said, well, could Chris Stevens, the ambassador, could he have emailed you directly? Because obviously they were friends. They've known each other for a long time. And, you know, she had to say, well, he didn't have my email address, which, of course, goes into her whole, you know, issue about she used a personal email for government business. But the situation was that they did ask. And I think the previous investigations, including the one you mentioned, the Accountability Review Board, had faulted the State Department for not, you know, more quickly heeding to those requests. But the question is, did she know about it? And she says she didn't know.
Rachel, and so much of it, certainly her server was one of the revelations earlier this spring that came out of this committee. But nonetheless, with the focus on email, it's almost as if she never made a phone call or never had a meeting. Do you think that was a problem for the Republicans because the focus is so much on, or has been so much on, what she emailed, who was able to email to her, what she emailed back to them?
Yeah, well, Republicans tried, when they played up the emails, they brought up Sidney Blumenthal quite often. He's a longtime Clinton ally who was not allowed to work at the State Department because of some things he said about President Obama during the 2008 Democratic primary. But he was a very close friend of hers. And throughout their probe, they have said that he sent her hundreds of pages worth of advice on Libya, what to do there, be bold there, support a no-fly zone. He also had apparently some business interests in Libya that he was trying to work on with the startup government. They basically tried to say to her, you know, Chris Stevens, these security requests that he was sending didn't get to you, but look, Sid Blumenthal's gossip and his advice for Libya and what you should do there, that was a priority for you. That made your inbox. And you're right. She oftentimes would retort back, well, I didn't do a lot of my work over email. She said she didn't even have a computer in her office. Most of her work is done face-to-face. It's done over the phone. It's done talking, you know, in person to people. And so she said that's – you're looking at emails. It's not the full story. And I do think that was one – thing that Republicans weren't quite ready to answer back for.
Anita, we're about a minute before our break here, but what is clear out of the testimony yesterday that got televised is just the bad blood between the Republicans and Democrats on this committee. I don't know if it has to do with, you know, the rest of Congress, but some really bad feelings between those members.
Yeah, I think, you know, as Rachel said, one of the things that's telling is there was no big moment for Clinton yesterday, good or bad. Well, it's probably good that there wasn't. But the moment that people remember is when the arguing started between the top Democrat and the top Republican, the chairman, Chairman Gowdy, where they basically had an argument, and Hillary Clinton sat at the table quietly. She actually was smiling, just listening to them basically go at it. I mean, it was definitely the most entertaining highlight of the, you know, that woke people up. And they basically were arguing about what they've been arguing for weeks, months, which is the rules of this committee. What's the purpose of the committee, and why don't they have the rules that some other committees have? And so the specific issue they were arguing about is, should Sidney Blumenthal's testimony be public? He had testified earlier in private.
Well, we have some of that argument queued up. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Anita Kumar. She covers the White House for McClatchy Newspapers, and with Rachel Bade, congressional reporter for Politico. And we are talking about yesterday's hearing, Hillary Clinton testifying before the House Select Committee on Benghazi. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Rachel Bade and Anita Kumar about yesterday's hearing before the House Select Committee on Benghazi. Hillary Clinton, the sole person to testify yesterday, and almost an 11-hour event for her. We were talking about the bad blood between the Republicans and Democrats on this committee. Here's just a portion of some of the back and forth between Elijah Cummings and Trey Gowdy. He's the chair of the committee, having to do with Sidney Blumenthal and emails. Let's give it a quick listen.
I move that we put into the record the entire transcript of Sidney Blumenthal. We're going to release the emails. Let's do the transcript. That way the world can see it.
Well,
the motion
has been seconded.
Well, we're not going to take that up at a hearing. We'll take that
Mr.
up
Chairman,
in a business
I've consulted
meeting.
With the parliamentarian, and they have informed us that we have a right to a recorded vote on that motion. We want, you know, you
well,
have
asked
for the
let's
truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Well, that's what we want to have. Let the world see it.
Why is it that you only want Mr. Blumenthal's transcript released? Why don't you
want the
survivors, even their names?
Let me tell you something. Right now,
the only one you've asked for is Sidney Blumenthal. That's the only one you've asked for. That and Miss Mills.
And on and on and on they went. Anita, the Democrats have been claiming, and some Republicans have given them some ammunition, that this committee is all about derailing Hillary Clinton's run for the White House. Do you think that holds water?
Well, I mean, it's hard to see a lot of what the committee's doing. Yesterday was their 54th person. They had 54 people to testify so far, but only four have been public, obviously one yesterday and three previous. And they aren't releasing the transcripts, and so we haven't really seen everything that's been going on. So we haven't seen some of the questioning. Now, if you talk to some of the people that have been testifying and some of their allies or the Clinton folks, they'll say, well, the questions they asked were not related to the Benghazi attacks. They were related to Hillary Clinton's emails and Sidney Blumenthal and other things. So it's quite hard to tell. One other criticism of the committee is that they started this year with an agenda to have certain hearings, certain public hearings, and that they have not had a lot of those hearings. And so the Democrats, you know, they have smartly played up that they that, you know, it's cost a lot of money, $4.7 million since May 2014 when they were created, and that we haven't, the public has not seen much yet.
And what the Republicans say, Rachel, is that people have been dragging their feet and trying to get all these emails so that they can do their job.
That's right. I did an interview with the chairman over the weekend before this, and he talked a lot about being sort of aghast at some of these things that the Democrats were sort of throwing at him, including the numbers of how many State Department employees he had interviewed versus, say, DOD or the CIA. He said, of course, I'm going to be interviewing more state employees because state was where the security broke down. State was where the security requests were denied. State was running this compound. I think he has said that, you know, these weeks have been among the worst weeks of his life. It's funny, though, because, you know, back when this committee was first formed, I remember talking to some of the Democrats on the panel, and they were so happy that Trey Gowdy was going to be leading this committee. Back then, he had a reputation for being, well, of course, very tough in terms mm-hmm. of questioning on the oversight committee, but people saw him generally as a fair person. Now, I would say, given the past couple weeks and a lot of the accusations, I mean, there's a lot of questions about the credibility of the panel. What I do think is sort of interesting is how Democrats, by criticizing the panel so much about changing its probe, have pretty much scared Republicans on that committee away from even doing any sort of big probe of the server issue. There was some talk a couple of months ago about whether or not they should get into that. Committees in Congress, in the House side, were told, do not probe the server issue because Trey Gowdy is going to look into this. He didn't want to, but, you know, ended up looking into it a little bit. And now they've definitely backed off, I would say, on the emails issue.
In fact, most of his questioning had to do with Sidney Blumenthal.
Right. I mean, exactly. I think a lot of the questions, what they were trying to say, you know, she was prioritizing his advice over, say, something Chris Stevens would do. But it wasn't until the 10th hour, I think, that we saw Jim Jordan started bringing up the server issue. And he sort of mocked Hillary Clinton, saying, you know, you call yourself the most transparent person ever, and yet you only started turning over these emails when we asked for them. You kept them for 2 years. You never turned them over. He said he talked about her, quote, changing story, a lot of the statements that she has backtracked on the email issue, and asked basically, how can we trust you?
You know, there's one question that I've had. I don't know if it was asked yesterday or not. Anita, I will put this to you, which is why Hillary Clinton didn't go on those, what I think it was, five talk shows the Sunday after Benghazi to talk about what happened that day. Instead, Susan Rice was the representative from the administration who went on those talk shows. And I've never quite understood who made that decision and why.
So funny that you said that. I didn't hear that question come up yesterday. I don't know if it did, but I will say that people, after the Susan Rice appeared, there was a lot of talk about that a few years ago. And, you know, someone made, one of the Republicans yesterday, I don't remember who, made a comment about how she just wanted to go on the talk shows in general
right.
and talk about her successes. And I kind of laughed to myself, Hillary Clinton doesn't like the Sunday talk shows. She doesn't want to do the Sunday talk shows. And I think there had been reporting a few years ago that she was not interested in doing that. And so the White House got Susan Rice to do it. And she did go on all the talk shows. And she used the talking points at the time that the Republicans, you know, dispute or say that they misled the American people on. But that's why Hillary Clinton didn't do it. Right. That's not really her thing. She doesn't really like to do it.
Well, and the question about whether it was this, you know, terrible video that inspired people or not, that was one of the original things that was said, not entirely, Anita. How much did that come up yesterday?
It did come up in a line of sort of tough questioning for her. There was one... you know, there were some new emails, and one of the emails showed Hillary Clinton giving an explanation to her daughter, Chelsea, by email the night of the attack, saying this happened. And she described it in a way that didn't mention the video at all. And the video you're talking about, that's what initially the White House and Susan Rice had said,
right.
that this video had spawned basically a, you know, spontaneous attack. Uprising. And of course, that turned out to be not true, and they backtracked on that. But she did not say that to Chelsea Clinton, and they were sort of saying, well, why were you telling your family the truth, but you weren't telling the American people the truth? And so that was a line of tough questioning for her. Was there a discrepancy, and did she know something at the time? And she just sort of pushed back on that and said, you know, we knew something at the beginning, we didn't. You know, we changed that later. They did not know the full story.
And that's Anita Kumar. She covers the White House for McClatchy Newspapers. Also with us is Rachel Bade. And she's a congressional reporter for Politico. And we are talking about what a lot of the country is talking about today. Yesterday, Hillary Clinton's testimony before the House Select Committee on Benghazi. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Let me get James from Chester County to join us. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, how you doing? I love your show.
Thanks.
Big Hillary fan, so I had to watch my girl in action. And I just thought, you know, along with watching her demonstrate her ability to maintain and her eligibility to be president, I just, every once in a while, I got this impression that, you know, airing our intelligence laundry like this, there was some kind of information, procedural or something, that would be beneficial to the enemy. You know, just every once in a while, I know that most of it was just like controlled partisan chaos, but it's just every once in a while, just you know, the strange nature of the way intelligence is gathered. I was just wondering what your guests thought about that. Was there anything that was said that was detrimental to the State Department and or the CIA in that way,
sure.
Giving up.
I hear you. Let me put that to Rachel Bay. James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Rachel, did you hear anything?
Detrimental?
Detrimental?
No, I don't think so. I think we saw a lot more detail. And so if someone is, you know, skeptical of Clinton, doesn't really like her, they might see some of the details that came out yesterday and, you know, have a more negative opinion of her. But I don't think that anyone, I think overall she was strong, as you said. I mean, she got grilled for 10, 11 hours. And I think she kept her cool. You know, she was snarky when she needed to be, serious when she needed to be. And overall, I think her performance was very strong.
Let me play one more clip. And this came near the end. And this was in response to Trey Gowdy talking about Admiral Mullen. Now, he was the co-chair of the ARB. And that's the – I'm scrambling for my little pieces of paper here – for the Accountability Review Board, which looked into the Benghazi – what happened in Benghazi. And Trey Gowdy really raised some questions about Admiral Mullen. And let's hear what Hillary Clinton said in response.
I really don't care what you all say about me. It doesn't bother me a bit. I do care a lot about what you're implying about Admiral Mullen, and I will not sit here and hear that.
Well,
Admiral Mullen,
ma'am,
served this country with great distinction. He served the State Department with great distinction in being the co-chair of the Accountability Review Board, and I think his work speaks for itself.
Well,
and I'm sorry that the important work that was done by that board is held in such low regard by some members of this committee, and I deeply regret it.
And Anita, one of the findings of the Accountability Review Board was that the military did everything they could under difficult circumstances, and one of the questions, I guess, that has dogged Hillary Clinton was some allegations that she had told the military to stand down. Can you speak to that?
I think what's really interesting about the Accountability Review Board, or what became interesting yesterday now all this time later, is it wasn't a particularly good report for her and for the State Department. It may have said what you said, that the military did what they could. There were a lot of negative pieces in there. They had a lot of 29, I think, recommendations. And they basically said on the front end, the security was not good, which is actually her responsibility. And so I think it's sort of amusing that they're fighting over this. She's sort of defending not a great report, and he's saying that it wasn't good enough. I think we've lost sight of that it wasn't actually very favorable to her. But, yes, I mean, they did exchange that, you know, have that exchange about the report. And one of Chairman Gowdy's talking points yesterday was definitely that, let me step back.
He
was very defensive about how people have been criticizing his committee. And so one of the things that he wanted to say was every other committee, seven other congressional committees, and this review board, they didn't do a good job. And so we're doing the job that people didn't do. And so it was he sort of needed to criticize those others to say why his committee has purpose. And so I understand why he was doing that. And perhaps he did have some points about these people were, you know, he says they weren't independent members and that they were handpicked. He did have points about that. But to me, it was interesting that people are saying, it's not like they said she did such a great job. I mean, they did say that things need to change, and it wasn't, the security was lax.
And that's Anita Kumar, who joins us along with Rachel Bade, and we are talking about yesterday's meeting, the House Select Committee on Benghazi meeting, and grilling Hillary Clinton, although it must be said that she had mostly friendly questions or comments from the Democrats on the committee. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Rachel, some of the Democrats were reluctant actually to appear on the committee yesterday. What happens next? And there was even some talk about whether they would sit on the committee going forward. Have they basically abandoned ship?
So I talked to Ranking Member Cummings and also Adam Schiff after the hearing last night about this. It sounds like a decision has not been made, but they're definitely hinting at it, making me think we very well could see them step away or resign from the committee. I do not think that just because, you know, Clinton had a pretty good performance yesterday, I don't think it was clear that Republicans think she neglected Libya and she did not do her duty there. So I do think going forward, they're going to continue with that sort of line of attack. And Democrats said, Schiff told me, if we don't see a change, we're going to step away. And I mean, I do not think we're going to see a change. I mean, I think they're showing what sort of direction they're going. And I don't, although I do think they'll interview more folks from the CIA and the DOD, and they've said they were going to do that. I don't think they're going to be backing off on this, taking away the heat that they have put on Hillary Clinton in these investigations.
Do you think there will be another committee organized to look at Benghazi?
No.
This is the last one for sure?
I'm probably 99.9% sure. I will say another thing. Just because, you know, Clinton had a good performance yesterday, she sort of won the news cycle, but she still has a lot of questions to answer going forward on the emails issue, which, as we said, didn't come up a lot yesterday.
Right.
One thing that did come up yesterday that is going to play into that is she often retorted back to Republicans that actually 95% of my emails were already at the State Department. And when that came up, you know, I was emailing with my colleague. He and I cover the emails issue as well. And he was like, where does that number come from? We don't even know what that number comes from. And at one point, Gowdy actually asked, where is that number coming from? And nobody can seem to figure out where that number is. So I think that's going to be the next line of questioning on the email issue. Were 95% of her emails really already at the State Department?
Well, Anita, you cover the White House for McClatchy. And any response or word out of the White House about Benghazi or how she did yesterday?
No, on Benghazi, they've pretty much been saying the same thing, that they're cooperating. They don't really see the need for the committee, but they're absolutely cooperating. They did have good words, good supportive words to say about Secretary Clinton yesterday, and how anyone who was watching could see, you know, exactly that she was, you know, why she was such a good Secretary of State. She could handle herself, and she cares so much about the issues that she was sitting there answering the questions. I mean, you know, this is really more about what's going to happen for her campaign going forward. And, you know, she's had a great, great week, no doubt about it, but she's got a lot of things still ahead of her. And probably the biggest one is she still has an FBI investigation into this email issue, and whether classified information and government secrets were compromised, and whether her email setup helped that happen. And so she's got debates, she's got to raise money, she's still got Senator Bernie Sanders right there, trying to defeat her. But I think the biggest thing she still has to deal with is this FBI investigation, and also that every month for a few more months we're still going to be seeing new batches of emails coming out of the State Department, which isn't particularly good for her.
Rachel, we have about 45 seconds before we have to say goodbye. Any final words or even a comment or two about the FBI investigation?
I think everyone wants to know sort of where they are, but I think that's going to take a long time. FBI probes can take months and months. But I would agree with Anita that that's pretty much her biggest challenge going forward, and what comes out of that, particularly because, you know, we've seen some reports that, you know, they've found some personal emails of her on the server that she says were deleted. And Republicans actually last night brought up about a dozen emails they have found from her that were work-related that she never turned over, and they only unearthed because they got them from other people. So I think one of the big questions is, if the FBI finds personal emails that actually weren't personal, that she deleted, could she get in even more trouble for getting rid of official records?
Well, stay tuned. Rachel Bade, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're welcome. Congressional reporter for Politico, Anita Kumar, thank you for joining us as well.
Sure, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she covers the White House for McClatchy. And we have David Herzenhorn waiting in the wings. And we'll be talking about Paul Ryan after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. It looks like Paul Ryan will be the next Speaker of the House of Representatives, barring some unforeseen event. John Boehner announced that he no longer wanted the job after he lost the support of members of his party, most notably the House Freedom Caucus. Ryan laid out a set of preconditions, including time to spend with his young family. The vote is scheduled for next week, and then there will be some serious decisions to be made, including a possible federal default in early November. We asked David Herzenhorn to join us. He's been covering the story for the New York Times, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have David Herzenhorn?
I'm here.
Okay, good. Nice to have you with us on
the
show.
Great to be with you, yeah.
Paul Ryan has said that he would take this job if he felt he could be a unifier. Do you think he got all the conditions that allowed him to do that?
Well, he seems to have. We've seen a very difficult situation for John Boehner, facing this constant pressure from the hard right flank of his own party. And what Paul Ryan did, which was quite deft, was actually throw the decision back on his colleagues, saying, look, I will do this, but only if you get behind me. And in particular, that was aimed at this hard right, hardline Freedom Caucus, about 40 members of Congress who have been resistant to the establishment in many ways, who want to be much more confrontational with Democrats and with President Obama. And in the end, they came together, and roughly 70% of them voted and said they would back Ryan for Speaker. Now, it's interesting, their own bylaws require 80% for a formal endorsement. So technically, the group is still formally endorsing a very little-known lawmaker from Florida named Dan Webster. But in fact, Ryan has their backing. And in doing that, he really did defang them because, you know, they're not following their own rules. They were making a big point in the last few days of how, you know, unlike the party leadership, they were following their rules. He really divided them, and there will be other rules changes likely that he's asked for that will make it easier for him going forward.
part of these preconditions? Was it about policy, or was it really just about procedure, about how bills make it through the House, for instance?
It was not about policy. In fact, they were very clear that none of the discussions that he had with them in the last few days were about health care or immigration or fiscal issues, any of the big issues facing the country right now, but rather about how the House operates in and of itself. What they've claimed is they want more power and authority for individual members. Now, there's a limit to how much you can do that in a legislative body of 435 members, but he's pledged to take a hard look at that, but it seems that he's getting more out of this than they are at this point.
You quoted Raul Labrador of Ohio, and he says, we want to make sure you understand that this is not about crowning a king. It's about working together. Was that their complaint about Boehner?
That was one of their complaints about Boehner. I mean, this is a complaint that you hear in legislatures everywhere. The leadership has most of the power. Committee chairmen and chairwomen are also quite powerful. But in the end, you know, the speaker holds the gavel and is in charge of quite a lot. I just returned from a four-year assignment based in Moscow. And in Ukraine in particular, we'd hear the same thing. You know, new members of this young government complaining, they get in and the leaders are in charge. And so this is not an unusual complaint. But yes, this is what their gripe was. And in fact, as relatively young members of the United States Congress, they didn't have enough say. They couldn't push as much legislation forward as they wanted. Now, the problem and other challenge that they face is because they come from the right wing of the party, the chances of that legislation getting anywhere, given a Democratic president in the White House and a Senate Democratic caucus that has enough votes to filibuster, you know, there's some reality here that a lot of observers say, hey, they're not recognizing.
What's so interesting to me is this is often described as the third most powerful job in America, you know, I guess you could say perhaps the world, because of America's status in the world. And yet it seems to be a job, certainly that John Boehner was very happy to say goodbye to, but that there was people kind of pushing Paul Ryan to take the job under these very specific preconditions.
Well, there's no question that for him personally, this is a big gamble for his political future. You know, speakers in modern times have, you know, lasted four years, maybe a little bit more. This is not a job that people have held for quite a long time, and it will be very difficult if he still harbors presidential ambitions, which we think he does. It will be much more difficult to run having served as Speaker of the House, where you inevitably have to make all sorts of tough compromises. So there's no question for him, you know, he will find himself in a tough spot contemplating what this means for him. Now, he could be speaker for quite a bit longer. He's the youngest speaker since the late 1860s. He's only 45 years old. He's got quite a future ahead of him. He's also an avowed policy wonk who's put forward some of the boldest budget and fiscal plans that we've seen from either party in Congress. Democrats might say some of that's absurd, but certainly he's ambitious in the sense that he wants to make some big changes in the country. And certainly as Speaker, as you said, it's a very powerful position, you know, leads the Congress. It's written into the Constitution, next in line to the presidency after the vice president. He will have quite a bit of leverage to pursue that agenda.
So maybe it's a job that isn't quite as powerful as people thought it used to be.
Well, for sure. It's, you know, there is a lot of pressure that comes in this modern age. Any member of Congress can go out and get on TV, can get on Twitter, you know, and can really raise a ruckus. And certainly they hear the response constantly coming from the media, from constituents who can make themselves heard much more immediately, louder and clearer than they could when all they could do was send a letter. So there are limits, but that's true about many jobs.
Sure, sure. I thought it was interesting that one of the limits he had was that he wanted to spend time with his family, his young children, which makes me wonder, and it sounded like he said, look, I don't want to work weekends. What does this job actually entail?
Well, the Speaker of the House, particularly in this situation where the Republicans control Congress and the House, but not the White House, is essentially the highest ranking elected official in the party nationally. For John Boehner, that's meant quite a lot of fundraising on the weekends or fundraising trips. One of the Freedom Caucus guys was joking that they didn't know how many of those weekend trips were about fundraising and how many were about golf. But in fact, Boehner did a good job, even if he was kidding. That was Mick Mulvaney from South Carolina. Boehner did a good job of combining the two. There's certainly a lot of work that happens after hours and on the weekends when budget negotiations go, you know, through the night. I think many Americans don't often grasp that just because there's gridlock in Washington, that doesn't necessarily mean people aren't working hard. Often you'll see members of Congress, you know, on the floor of the House or Senate, you know, at midnight battling something out. You know, again, the results may be frustrating because not much gets done. But indeed, these are very, very demanding jobs. A lot of travel for somebody like Ryan, who has three young kids. He tries to get back to Janesville, Wisconsin every weekend. Was out there over the Columbus break, you know, putting up Halloween decorations. That's very important to him and his family to have that family time. So it seems that his colleagues are ready to make some accommodations. But certainly, it's an interesting moment where you hear a dad sort of making clear in the public sphere that this time is important and needs to be protected.
I'm thinking about John Boehner a couple of weeks ago singing Zippity-Doo-Dah. I mean, obviously very happy to give up this job. Why did he have such a hard time? With his own party, I should add.
Yeah, well, the Republican Party is going through quite a difficult transition right now where there's disagreement over how strongly to confront Obama and the Democrats. There's a lot of frustration that over the years of the Obama presidency, of course, we had a stretch early on where the Democrats controlled the House and had 60 votes in the Senate. That's how the Affordable Care Act got done. So there's a lot of anger and frustration about, you know, not being able to undo some of these things that they were really opposed to. And also, you know, there was this grassroots Tea Party movement, you know it well, that came to the forefront in 2010 when the Republicans won back the House. And so almost immediately from the moment John Boehner became Speaker, he had to deal with these new members of Congress who really wanted to shake up Washington, shake up the way Washington does business. Boehner, as conservative as he is, was certainly part of the Washington establishment. And it was the Washington establishment that the Tea Party was railing against.
But isn't Paul Ryan part of the establishment? He was Mitt Romney's vice president, so selected him to run with him as vice president. Do they see him as part of the establishment?
Many of them do, and you're absolutely right. I mean, this is Paul Ryan who got his start, you know, working for Jack Kemp, one of his idols, who has always dreamed of being chairman of the tax writing Ways and Means Committee. You know, that's not every kid's dream, not being a baseball player or a rock star. And so certainly that is one of the concerns that these guys on the far right had in criticizing him and saying they were skeptical of him. Now, what we have seen is, in the end, they have bowed to political reality, that, in fact, if you were going to get someone who could unify this very fractured Republican conference, you needed someone who would have the respect of everyone. And that comes from having experience, as Tom Cole, a congressman from Oklahoma, said, there's only one guy who he felt could unite the party, only one guy who had national stature, largely because he was the nominee for vice president. And so, this is the trade-off. The alternative would be someone unknown. They have somebody like that, Daniel Webster. Formally, he's been endorsed, but he has no chance of becoming speaker.
So John Boehner, I mean, when the vote is set for next week, is that right?
That's right. There'll be an internal Republican vote on Wednesday in which Ryan will need only the majority of the Republican conference. Now, he's expected to quite a bit more than that. Then on Thursday, there's a formal vote on the House floor. At that point, he needs actually a majority of the whole House, which would be 218 votes. Democrats, by tradition, will vote for Nancy Pelosi, their leader, who will lose. So this is where the math has gotten complicated, and it was for Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader, where it was clear he could win the vote within the Republican conference. But once out on the floor, there would not necessarily be enough votes to get him over 218 to 218 without the help of Democrats, which by tradition they just wouldn't do.
And that's David Herzenhorn, our guest in this portion of Radio Times. We're talking about Paul Ryan. It looks like he will be the next Speaker of the House of Representatives after some back and forth over the last couple of weeks. And it is a job described as the third most powerful job in the country. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, there are some things on the table that are going to have to be dealt with, including there's a possible default on the horizon?
Yes, the Treasury Department says that by November 3rd, the government will reach its borrowing limit. We hit the debt ceiling, and at that point, if Congress has not agreed to lift the limit, then the government would default. default on its bills. That's something that leaders in both parties say they won't allow happen. But there is quite a lot of disagreement over how to get to the point where Congress does agree to raise the debt ceiling. Again, these are this is something that Boehner, I think, as a favor to Paul Ryan, would like to get out of the way before Wednesday's election. What the Democrats are calling for, President Obama has said quite emphatically that he will not negotiate again over the debt ceiling, that, in fact, Congress has to be prepared to honor the financial obligations of the United States. And indeed, you know, the 14th Amendment makes clear that the debt should not be called into question, the validity of the debt. Now, what some Republicans would like to see is some major fiscal reform, some changes in mandatory spending on entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. That seems unlikely, and so there's a bit of wrangling that will have to happen before we get to what's known as a clean increase in the debt ceiling, a bill that would just raise that debt limit from now just over $18 trillion to up in around $19.5 trillion.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And David, there's a highway bill, right?
There's all sorts of things, you know, that make this sort of the worst time for Congress to have gone through a leadership crisis. We're right now in a temporary budget, essentially, which runs through December 11th. So there are only 2 months left in this temporary spending plan that they agreed to keep the government operating. There's a difference between, you know, having the government functioning and having the ability to borrow the money needed to pay the bills. There are a number of highway programs that will expire at the end of the month that there are bills out there that would take care of that, but they have to get their minds together and get that done. Of course, there's a continuing fight over the Export-Import Bank that's divided Congress quite heavily. Just an endless number of things that are going on, you know, all with the presidential campaign heating up in the background that, of course, you know, adds pressure.
And drama to what we're talking about. Is there any way to know if Paul Ryan has a relationship with President Obama? Certainly, John Boehner had to sit and negotiate some of this stuff with the president. What do you anticipate between these two gentlemen?
You know, Paul Ryan has shown, and this may be a concern for some of the folks on his right flank in the Republican Party, but Paul Ryan has shown an ability to negotiate and work with Democrats. In fact, he was integral to the last big agreement on spending, working with Patty Murray, Senator, Democratic senator from the state of Washington. They reached an agreement to lift the previous spending caps that had been put in place. That bill, the Ryan-Murray deal, named for the two of them, was really one of the best examples of one of the few examples of serious cooperation that took place between Democrats and Republicans. So he is a guy who does want to get things done. He's made that clear. He said that repeatedly in these days ahead of formally saying that he was seeking the speakership. There is a possibility. I think there are a lot of observers who hold this out, that with President Obama nearing the end of his term as a lame duck president, with Paul Ryan having, you know, aspirations to a bigger political future, that maybe they can get some really big things done over the next year and a half.
How do you think that will play with the House Freedom Caucus?
You know, it depends what it is. If he can deliver, if he can show them that, you know, there's a deal that that still abides by conservative principles, which he, you know, has been certainly, you know, has some credibility in that department. It may be that they are glad to go along. It's hard to imagine, of course, given the rancor and partisanship that we've seen the last few years. Certainly, it's been characterized here in Washington much more by division and disagreement than by cooperation and bipartisanship. But, you know, there are members of both parties at the outer edges who certainly aren't all that willing to compromise. There's a big country to run, though.
Indeed, there is. David Herzenhorn, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure.
And he's a reporter for The New York Times, has been covering the story of the hunt for the new Speaker of the House. And again, it looks like it will be Paul Ryan. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. Send us an email. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.